This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 22nd, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a number of the developments that happened this week. First thing we're going to look at is a taxpayer who was trying to claim a dependency exemption for his child. He was not the custodial parent under the tax law. There didn't submit the 8332. Obviously, that's a problem. But in this case, he actually got the 8332 prior to the tax court hearing date. Still didn't help him. We also have the IRS issued a notice that added additional items of preventive care that high-deductible health plans can pay. A lot of these are related to diagnosed diseases. Their preventive care when the disease has been diagnosed are now allowed to be paid for by the health care plan. We'll discuss kind of what they added and what that means to us. And finally, if you're one of the few that just love the brand new 1040 postcard, well, it's going to be a short-lived love affair. Turns out the IRS now is come out with their drafts for 2019. We will have a new Form 1040 type called the 1040-SR that was mandated by Congress in 2018. But we're also going to have a virtually identical 1040 form that, in fact, will add a number of lines compared to the old postcard. And so we're going to get a brand new standard 1040, both of which were released this week in draft form. I'm going to discuss what they released, what we've got, and what changes that makes to what we've been doing on our tax filings. Well, it's this week. I'm going to be heading out to Albuquerque this week. I'm going to be doing a couple of sessions on Monday and Tuesday. And my next up after I finish, that's going to be here in Phoenix. In August, I will have courses on August the 14th for income taxation of trusts and estates. We will talk there about the Uniform Principal and Income Act as it applies that calculation. Have a new course we have on August 15th, CLE Tax Planning Concepts and Issues. We'll talk about general tax planning concepts, and then we'll talk about some specific tax planning items you may undertake in your business or for your clients. We'll talk about things like using tax deferrals on qualified retirement plans. We'll talk about 1202 stock. We'll talk about a bunch of other neat little tax planning concepts. Finally, on the 16th, we'll have partnership and LLC taxation, advanced issues. That course will look at a number of things that are happening in the partnership tax realm. We'll take a look at target capital accounts, how those type of agreements function. We'll take a look at other issues dealing with keeping track of capital accounts in a partnership structure, why that's important, and what we mean by capital accounts in a tax context, at least for that purpose. So we'll have that coming up on the 16th. All of those can be registered at the Arizona Society of CPAs website. You can also find them. You can also find webcasts at that site. So if you want to sign up for the Arizona Society courses, you can. I will, after I finish that, be heading on to South Dakota. We'll have a couple of days there. If you're in South Dakota, you can check the South Dakota website. They'll show you what we'll be talking about there. So we'll have a number of things to discuss in the month of August. Let's talk about our developments this week, though. Let's start with the case of DeMar versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2019-91, which was issued on July the 18th. Now, this deals with an issue we've discussed multiple times before. That is the problem that arises with a divorced set of parents where one parent has physical custody of the child for the year and the other parent is supposed to claim the dependency exemption. Congress, a number of years ago, decided that they really didn't want the courts to be having to sit down, figure out all these crazy details, such as who provided more of the support, and, you know, having to maybe read divorce decrees to figure out if somebody's supposed to be assigned it, and what the rules were. We're just done with that. The mechanical test now is fairly simple. If we have divorced parents, the only real thing we look at is between the two of them, do they provide over half the child support? Now, that could be 100% provided by one, 0% by the other. It could be 50-50. It could be 60-40. It could be 80-20. We don't particularly care as long as the two parents combined provide over half the child support. If they do that, then the custodial parent, and this is a term defined by the IRC, not by your divorce decree, the custodial parent is the one who is deemed to be able to claim the exemption unless the custodial parent signs a document that's outlined in the regulations that specifically assigns that exemption to the other taxpayer, to the other parent, for the year in question. If that is not signed and submitted with the non-custodial parent's return, the non-custodial parent cannot claim the dependency exemption. Now you may think, wait, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, didn't that get rid of dependency exemptions? Does any of this matter anymore? And the answer is, yeah, it still does. Because one of the things that is going to be affected by this is whether a parent can claim the child tax credit. So that still is there. Remember, the child tax credit, which was expanded, is what really takes over for the dependency exemption, and now we're able to claim that credit. So because of that, it is still an important detail. And as we know, the catch then becomes who's custodial parent. Well, the definition of custodial parent is found in Reg 1.152-4 in D. And what it basically says is, where does the child spend the greater number of nights? Note, this test is a federal test, not a state law test. It does not matter what the divorce decree says about who's the custodial parent. The custodial parent is the one that has a child stay with them the most nights. So for instance, if we have a parent who is granted custody, but let's say that parent's granted custody, the child is now, you know, completing their junior year of high school. The parent who's granted custody gets this wondrous job offer all the way across the country. Not surprisingly, the child may complain about having to leave high school the year before they graduate to go start in a brand new location. Lots of reasons they wouldn't be thrilled with doing that. They may balk. In a situation like that, the custodial parent may decide that the child could go ahead and live for that year with the other parent. If the custodial parent decides that, the one who's been granted state law custody, that's going to convert who's the custodial parent. Assuming, let's say, it's happened at the end of the junior year, so we're in April, that parent who was not the one who says is custodial per the divorce decree is nevertheless going to be the custodial parent for tax purposes because of the count the nights rule. The count the nights rule will apply. So if the one who is said is custodial per the divorce decree is going to be able to claim the child, then they will need to get a document signed by the parent who is listed as not custodial on the divorce decree. Remember, it is not a state law test, it's a federal test. Similarly, we don't particularly care what the divorce decree says. You have to have an item in writing. This is Reg 1.152E2. I should say, actually, Section 1.152E2 provides the written declaration requirement. And in the regulations, we're going to find that basically the regulations back here at 1.152-4E, E1 tells us the written form of declaration basically has to be the 8332. If it's not the 8332, then it has to be an unconditional declaration on a sheet of paper by itself, nothing else on that, that contains everything that's in the 8382. The divorce decree itself will not fulfill the requirement found in the regulation. The regulation basically has to be solely that purpose, you know, and that's a problem. So the decree doesn't work. In this situation, it provided that Mr. DeMar was going to be able to claim the child on his return in odd numbered years so long as he stayed current on his child support. The agreement even said, which is, you know, sometimes agreements don't say this, but this one, the attorneys that drafted it got the idea right. It's the execution that ends up causing problems for the taxpayer in this case. The decree says that the parent who has custody of the child will sign the 8332 and deliver it to this gentleman as long as he's current as child support. We don't hear in the case for sure, but it seems, because nobody's disputing this, that he was current. It was an odd numbered year. There's no question about that. It was his year to claim the child. but when he filed his return, he did not file an 8332. Now, as a practical matter, that probably wouldn't have caused him a problem, except, of course, the other parent claimed the child on her return as well. That does cause a problem, because now we have an issue. When the other parent claims the child on her return, that means the IRS looks around and sees two returns, same child. Obviously, that's a problem. The IRS, therefore, eventually, now we all know how this really works. The first parent to file got their return electronically filed with no problem. The second parent, as soon as they tried to e-file, was told, tough luck, child's number has been used. That parent files anyway and claims the child. And so then the IRS eventually starts working out the difference in the two. And my experience has been it takes actually quite a while for the service to finally get around to trying to sort out who's really the one that should get it. They usually go ahead and pay both and then go back and start figuring out where the problem is, which seems a little weird because having paid both, they know they paid too much money to somebody. They just don't know who. But they work that out, and I've been down that path. Now, the other thing I discovered the most recent time I had to do it was how the person for the IRS working the issue didn't understand this rule either. So started asking for copies of the divorce decree, which basically wasn't relevant. It's relevant, you know, and hey, and it actually did say, you know, all the conditions and everything. But the reality was that unless the custodial parent had signed the document over, it didn't matter. So the real question was count the days and then figure out if there's a signature that's been given. Those are the two issues. The parent who claims to be custodial needs to be able to prove more nights, and the parent that's non-custodial needs to have that piece of paper. If the parent that's custodial can count the nights, they're going to get it unless that piece of paper comes up. The non-custodial parent really doesn't matter in theory what the custodial parent does if the non-custodial parent can't produce a piece of paper. So, kind of an issue. In this case, he didn't have the piece of paper when we went to audit. He didn't get the piece of paper all the way up through the 90-day letter, but following the 90-day letter, he did get the piece of paper signed. The Form 8382 was signed by his former spouse. You might think, well, that's okay. He now has it. And the tax court admitted that nothing in the law tells us how late, you know, we're able to get this document. But it's kind of silent either way, whether you can do an amended return or not. You're supposed to attach this to your return. Can you do it on an amended return? Can you do it on an exam? Well, the court points out we have proposed regulations. Basically, 1.152-4E2I that tells us that essentially we actually can do it on an amended return or during an examination. But here's the caveat. If it was not placed on the non-custodial parent's original return and the other parent claimed the child on her return, which she did, then this produce the document on exam or on amended return only works to give this person the exemption if the other parent who provided the documentation late has filed an amended return and taken the child off. If that's not happened, then this late filing doesn't work. What that means is, and the court said, yeah, it's proposed regs, but we don't have any guidance on the other stuff, so we're going to use the proposed reg. Under if the proposed reg becomes final, or even at this point appears the court is willing to use it, it suggests that if you don't put on the original return, you as non-custodial parent have major problems trying to get it back because you've got to hope that your former spouse actually files an amended return, even if you haul that person to court and get that person to sign the document, which in many cases you might have to do. Again, there's lots of conflict in divorce. Lots of times the parties aren't getting along real well. Issues of child support, etc. It really gets messy. And so there may be a real mess where one party decides they want to punish the other, so they just won't sign the document. You get into that whole long discussion as to how it works. Yeah, that's why often we get hauled to court. But if you're hauled to court, you better make sure not only will the other party be ordered to sign the document, but the other party will be ordered to actually file an amended return to take the child off of that person's return, because appears that's what the courts now are going to want. You know, in this case, at least, that was fatal. At the end of the day, because he couldn't show that his ex-wife had ever filed that amended return and taken the child off her return, the court denied his claim to claim the dependency exemption. Okay. This is not rocket science, and as I said, this case even is somewhat unique because a lot of the cases come to court on this. The divorce decree itself never really had language that forced a non-custodial spouse to sign, presents lots of problems, but this one, they got it all right. Execution was the problem. And yes, I know when a client comes in and they don't have that document, and you ask them for the document, and then they say, well, you know, my former spouse is being a pain, and, you know, he or she isn't talking, and I don't really want to talk to him. You know, I'm just going to be, just going to start a fight. It's like, well, great, but if you don't talk to him, you don't get to claim the exemption. We have to have the signed form. Remember as well, and this is big, if you're claiming the child credit, then you as the preparer have got to do your due diligence. You need to ask the taxpayer, are you the custodial parent, if it's a divorce situation? And you have to ask them about the nights. And if their answer is they can't prove the nights or they don't have the nights, then you have to have the 8332. The regulations are very clear. Alternatives don't work. You know, or I should say, it's going to, by the time you get a workable alternative under the language of the regulation, you're going to have an 8332, so just go get the real form signed. That'll be a lot simpler. That's a problem. And, you know, these cases continue to come to the courts. They come to the courts because parties in a divorce, you know, don't always get along. But like it or not, we have to still, you know, tell our clients, and it's a service to the client who doesn't have it, that as distasteful as it might be, their options may be to go on extension and then go to court and get the paper signed so that their original return has the paper on it, or they're going to lose the dependency exemption they're supposed to be getting. And yeah, then I know the problem is if you have to go to court, the cost of going to court, it may be very well more than the child credit. Yeah, I can't help you there. I mean, that's just, life's unfair. And you have to live with that basic unfairness. You've got to get the document signed. If it's not signed, the non-custodial parent is simply out of luck under these rules. Well, let's talk about something a little more upbeat, shall we say. IRS, in Notice 2019-45, added to the list of preventive care items that can be provided under high-deductible health plans. Now, why this is important is because this gets into this whole area of health savings accounts. And to be a qualified high deductible health plan, HDHP, a few criteria must be met. You have to have certain minimum deductibles. You have to have maximum out of pocket. One of the key criteria, though, is that you cannot provide a benefit except for certain preventive care and some other limited items. You cannot provide a benefit to the insured under the insurance program until such time as they have used up their deductible. Now, why the preventive care list is important? Because this is one of the exceptions. Policies can provide preventive care without requiring you to meet your deductible. The theory being the preventive care will reduce medical expenses generally, make it less likely you'd go all the way through to your deductible. And so because of that, it just makes sense, because then the insurance company is going to pay less out by having you do the preventive work as opposed to having you not do preventive work because it's not covered and then end up in the hospital. The key issue that comes into play here, obviously, is this only comes into impact if there's a health savings account in play. If there's a health savings account that's being funded by the employer, or if the employee is deferring into a cafeteria plan, or if the employee is simply, or the self-employed person, is simply contributing to the HSA, right? All of which give us what's effectively a deduction from income for the amounts to go in there. We're able to do that, but the only coverage we can have is going to be the high deductible health plan coverage If with the self-only program on ourselves, that's required. If it's not self-only and it covers ourself and more, then the others that are involved in this also cannot have disqualifying coverage. Now, the actual list is found. You'll see it in our materials that are available. And it's a list of a few items. Generally it involves where you're diagnosed with certain conditions, some of the conditions whose diagnosis will now allow you to do certain other things include congestive heart failure, diabetes, coronary artery disease, osteoporosis, asthma, liver disease, bleeding disorders, and certain other heart diseases. All of these things, and you can do, they include things like statins for heart disease or diabetes, beta blockers for congestive heart failures or coronary artery disease, a blood pressure monitor being paid for hypertension. All of these things kind of, work for that. A peak flow meter for asthma, INR testing if you have liver disease or bleeding disorders, LDL, low density lipoprotein, the LDL testing if you have heart disease. All of these sorts of things are now can be covered by the policies. Now, the key issue is obviously it doesn't matter until we actually have them in the policy and they're covered. As well, some people are concerned that, in fact, the prior guidance was kind of open on what worked, and some are concerned that this may, in fact, restrict things, that insurers may simply now only come from the list because it's not clear if you go off the list, are you still a high deductible health plan that allows HSA contributions, or does your insurance plan now no longer qualify for that, which is bad if you're selling it that it does qualify. So we'll have to see if the IRS gives any sort of transition, if they really mean for this to be, because they do suggest in the notice that they're going to be kind of strict on just the list is what's allowed. So you'll need to keep your eye on that if that's a problem. They also indicated they plan to update this list every 5 years to make sure it's current with how medicine's working. 5 years seems like a long time to wait between updating this list. We'll see, but for the moment, that's all they're saying is they'll come back in 5 years, they'll revisit the list, they'll see if they should add something else to it. So in any event, we do have this new list of things. It is possible. Certainly we know for sure if you have a preventive care item that's on the list, we do know that the insurance coverage now or the insurance policy now can cover that. So that may be good news if you're having to pay for things that are on the list. Well, one of the least popular things that came out last year, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act had a lot of unpopular things happen with regard to it, I'll admit. It had popular things too, let's give it both ways. But obviously it wasn't all good news. But one of the things that, at least for CPAs, seemed to cause us more angst than almost anything else, is kind of funny, but it really does. And it really bothered us because it didn't add down. What are we talking about? The 1040 postcard. Well, the 1040 postcard, it's time to say farewell to the 1040 postcard. It's gone. It will be gone. I'm going to say you're still going to be on your extended 18 returns. You'll have the postcard. But beginning in 2019 now, if the draft form goes forward as currently created, and it seems highly likely it will, we will no longer see the draft. We'll no longer see the postcard. Now, the IRS actually issued two forms this week in draft form. They issued the form 1040-SR. The 1040-SR is a form mandated by Congress as part of the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018. There are some criteria for this. The 1040-SR that they mandated be done, it's a form that can only be used by individuals who have attained age 65 by the end of the year. Remember that one for a second, because it's a little weird, but we've got it. And then secondly, it has to be able to be used to file returns even if the taxpayer's income for the year includes Social Security benefits, distribution of qualified retirement plans, annuities, or similar deferred payment arrangements, interest and dividends, and capital gains and losses, right? And it can't be limited based on you having too much of any of those. So it has to be used by anybody who has any of those items of income, regardless of how much of such income they have. Now, this gets interesting because what the IRS did, and they released this form first. It was released on July 11th. They released this form, which is the SR. The SR form we'll talk about, but realize it actually can be used to file any return for somebody over 65 because there's really no restrictions on what can be reported on it. It's an interesting form. The other thing the IRS brought out this week, and we'll talk about this one here too, is they brought out a brand new Form 1040 that will be able to be used for 2019. The new Form 1040 is no longer the, quote, postcard half page. It's now about two-thirds of a page on each side. And CPAs will love it. It adds down. No longer is there a magic number on a schedule somewhere that you don't see anywhere on the front of the 1040, but you have to subtract out to make things work. The magic numbers are gone. Rather, we simply have something now that works. So if you take a look at the 1040 SR, those of you who are watching the video here, I'm going to put it up on the screen. Those of you who are listening to the audio, if you download our PDF from the website, you can actually get a look at this. We have it in the PDF, the actual copy of the 1040 SR. You can also find it on the IRS website. The 1040 SR has all the standard things, name, address, dependents, all that sort of thing. And then on the bottom of the front page, it puts together what's effectively eight lines that lead you to what will be adjusted gross income on line 8B. Okay. Now, on these, there are dedicated lines for wages, tax-exempt interest, qualified interest, dividends, right? Okay. IRA, distributions, pensions and annuities, right? We have those. Social Security benefits, capital gains, other income, right? And other income will come from Schedule 1 of the form. So the theory is now we'll have all of this here together. We'll be able to make all this work. It adds down then to total income. You then have the adjustments coming from Schedule 1. They get their own line this year on the 1040. And then we get to adjusted gross income. Below that, we have the standard deduction on line 9, the qualified business income amount on line 10, which will come from form 8995 or 8995A. Remember, we have a form for that this year. We'll then come down to taxable income. Now, the form 1040 SR below that line 11B for taxable income has a standard deduction chart. Okay, that chart's somewhat important. Couple of neat things about that chart. The chart refers you back to the top of the form, where the top of the form has there, right? You look at number of check boxes in age and blindness. Now remember, if you're not 65 or older, you're not supposed to be able to use this form. The age and blindness says you are over 65, or you're blind. Well, blind, let's leave aside, right? But at least, seems like at least one person with this return, if it's a married couple filing joint return, one of them, if it's a single person, that person should be over 65. It doesn't seem like there is any way to get that box to be zero and be eligible to file this form, but we have an entry there for if the box is zero, put this in. Does that mean the IRS is going to go ahead and say, we don't care what Congress said, anybody could use this form? Or not quite sure, because we're going to find out there's another quirky thing about these forms that's going to come up here fairly quickly. But let's continue. So nevertheless, you have there at the bottom. The nice thing is it does have a schedule, so if they're both over 65, you'll be able to quickly look, see married filing joint, two over 65, their standard deduction is $27,000. If they're both over 65 and they're both blind, then we are at 29.6, right? If they're single, they're over 65, 13.850, whatever it might be, we get to the right number, okay? Interesting enough, married filing separate, they have go to 4 as well, which is kind of interesting, but I'll leave that to you as to why they took that to 4, I think just to balance the chart as far as I could tell. So it's tough to see how married separate's going to essentially also get that, I guess. I don't know why it's there. We'll just leave it at that. The second page of the return starts with the tax computation and moves on down, right? Remember, instead of like the old 1040, we went to AGI on the front page. Now we're just going to go to taxable income on the front page. It's still a rather obvious cutoff point. It makes sense. We'll go to tax. We get credits on the front page of the return. We get done. We have our payments and our tax. We then have at the bottom of the return on line 20, we get our refund or the amount we owe on line 23. We have the third-party designee on this form. We have our signature line. We have our paid preparer line. So everything's there. Now, it does still use statements 1 through 3. You're going to see those are referenced on the front page of the form. We'll talk about that here in just a second, where statements 1 to 3 come into the mix. But they're there. And in fact, you're going to find out that we actually borrow the same statements are used for the 1040 SR and the 1040. Well, okay, there's our form for seniors. So obviously, seniors were meant to have their own special form. Now, of course, nothing said that the IRS could not make the form be eligible to be used no matter what income you had, nor did it say that they couldn't essentially design the same form to be a regular 1040. Well, here it comes. The new 1040. And the only real difference you see on the draft form is that it's got kind of that aqua background the 1040s have, that aqua green. I guess aqua is the closest you can say for color. Background is on it. But otherwise, gang, it's basically almost identical to the 1040 SR. I think it is actually identical in the sense that if you have a, you know, when we look at the line items, they're the same line items are there, the same schedules are used. It's basically the same form. And like the 1040 SR, these lines go on for 2/3 of a page. We're up from the half a page we had for the postcard 1040. Like the 1040 SR, we start out with name, address, dependents. You can claim over 65. You know, you can still use this form. It doesn't really hurt you there. On the actual bottom half of the page, we have our same basic lines we had on the 1040 SR. I mean, taxable income still line 11B, standard deductions line 9, line 10 is a qualified business income deduction. Everything's where it was. The only real difference is instead of that standard deduction table, we have the old little standard deduction balloon that we've had before and tells us the basic standard deduction amount and then tells you to see instructions if you have to go for aged or blind. Okay, so apparently, to be totally honest, the only real thing that's helpful to those over 65 with the 1040 SR is they don't have to go look at the schedules. And, you know, and I find it kind of interesting because there's plenty of room at the bottom of the 1040 to put that same schedule they put on for the 1040 SR. You know, it's just they didn't put it there because, hey, you know, my guess is they don't want to put it there because they're afraid people will use it who, you know, I'm nowhere near that level, but just will use it because it looks like something to play with, so they'll play with it. The back of the form, again, very much like the 1040 SR. The same stuff is basically there. Line 20 is where the refunds will be. Line 23 is where the amount you owe. The bottom part of the form has the third-party designee, the signature block, and the paid preparer block. In essence, we just killed the postcard. So the postcard is gone. It's not going to come back. What that does mean is that, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, you're going to have some reason to look back at 2018, and you're probably going to slap yourself when you do and say, oh, not this. This is the year I got to go remember how this crazy one works, that there's numbers that aren't on the form that are included. And that's why nothing seems to make sense. Yeah. The 2018 will be the odd year that has the odd 1040. It'll just be back there permanently. It's kind of like, remember that short period of time we had the odd 1040X that didn't have the middle column? You know, and yeah, and nobody liked that form either. We went back to the old. Well, we're going back to the old. So the postcard, dead. We also reduce our schedule some. We have three schedules this year. And notice if you're watching this on the broadcast, on the video version on the broadcast, you notice that where it says Schedule 1, it says Form 1040 or 1040 SR. These schedules work for both. Schedule 1 has all the income items that didn't fit on the front page. That includes any business income from Schedule C's on there, rents and royalties, S corporations on Schedule E, that line makes it there. Remember, capital gains or losses did make it to the front page of the return. That's there. We also have the adjustments to income. That's there on Part 2 of Schedule 1. And all those things that used to be at the bottom of page 1040. But we are now going to pick up a line and actually put them on Form 1040 or Form 1040 SR. All numbers will flow there. The main lead form will add down. Schedule 2 is the other taxes, the AMT, the advanced premium credit, self-employment taxes, the additional Medicare tax, right? Any premature distribution tax, household employee taxes. All of those sorts of things. If you have a Section 965 tax liability installment from Form 965A, you put that on there too, and you interrupt these total taxes. On Schedule 3, we have our credits, non-refundable credits, and then other payments, which include estimated tax payments. They still haven't made it back to the return. Plus, any refundable credits end up on Schedule 3. What we lost in schedules. We got rid of three schedules. We got rid of Schedule 2, which is tax computation, Schedule 3, non-refundable credits, and Schedule 6, the foreign address and third-party designee. The items that were on those schedules are basically now on the Form 1040. And because we got rid of Schedules 2, 3, and 6, we basically just renumbered what was left over to fit there. So we go from 1 to last year's 4 and 5 is basically what's there, and there's actually some stuff taken off of either one of those, taken off a couple of those too, but what we had basically is last year's schedules 1, 4, and 5 survived, 2, 3, 6 gone. They're now part of the 1040 itself. I suspect very few people are going to be complaining about the loss of the 1040 postcard. I'm not sure very many people were thrilled with it. It seemed like only the Treasury Secretary seemed to be the person who really thought it was a wondrous thing. He was excited when he announced it, and everybody else get excited about the postcard, and now the postcard's just kind of gone. Well, it's CPE registration time. Don't forget, check your state society's catalogs. Register now to get your 2019 CPE. We are having things come out. The IRS is doing stuff. By the way, just so you're aware, I'm recording this a little bit early on Friday because I'm going to have to leave on Sunday to get to Albuquerque. I normally leave early, camp out, because Albuquerque Airport's a nice place to camp out and write, actually. But it's not a very good place to record a podcast. It's a little noisy for that. But I will be camping out there, so I need to get this recorded a little bit in advance. I'm recording it on Friday afternoon to get it all edited, uploaded, and done before I have to leave for Albuquerque. Check your catalogs. We do know, though, today, on Friday, Politico reported that Representative Neal, who is the chair of Ways and Means, seemed to believe that maybe the SECURE Act would get attached to the budget agreement, which may or may not have collapsed or may or may not now be done by the time you listen to this. That's one of those odd things. We have no idea what's going to happen. That thing is done when it's passed and signed. And until then, it's not done. But it's possible if it does get attached that the SECURE Act could suddenly become a big deal. Your state societies will help you deal with that, both in the scheduled CPE they have now, plus CPE that they will probably schedule when that act comes in, because I've got a whole course written on the SECURE Act. I just can't do anything with it because it's not the law yet. So check your state society, see what's going on, register for your CPE, find out what's happening, get ready for that stuff. The live stuff this year is really important. Again, current federal tax developments, you can find our updates on the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also send questions and comments to me. I'm at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter, my Twitter handle, @edzollers. I generally post there, not a whole bunch of political screeds, not a whole bunch of discussions of what I had for lunch today. You get to see the picture of my hamburger for the day. Rather, I just post when we post tax issues that have arisen mainly there. You can also follow discussions. I do go to Reddit The subreddit /r/taxpros has information. By the way, that was where this week, like the first calling I got for the 1040 SR and for the regular 1040 were posts people put onto that subreddit. Useful place to look. But I also follow the discussions on three state societies that I'm members of who all have Connect as their discussion group. That includes the Arizona, the Minnesota, and the New Jersey Society. So you can go on there. And if you have any issues, you're a member of those societies, you can log in, post questions. If I see it and I think I can help, I'll try to respond. You also can go, the California Society has a discussion group open to everybody, any CPA, anywhere in the country. That's Tax Talk, Yahoo Group's Tax Talk, where you find that one. So if your state society doesn't offer you that sort of Connect site or equivalent to a Connect or a discussion group site, you might want to take a look at California's offering. It'll give you a lot of the same things. Just won't be really helpful, though. You probably won't get many questions answered about a state income tax problem that's not California, but you know, that's kind of the nature of the beast. You know, go ahead, check in. Really great place to get information from. Well, as I say, it's one of those weeks, maybe, you know, maybe Senator Neal's, maybe not Senator, moved into the wrong side. I'm talking about Representative Neal. If he's right, maybe we're going to be talking about the Secure Act next week and what the Secure Act would mean. If not, we're probably going to have plenty of other updates to deal with. So we'll see you here next week on current federal tax developments. Be sure to join us here.